You're listening to an Alalon Netcast, the Roxburgh Journal.
This edition of the Roxburgh Journal comes to you from London, England, where we sat in a hotel room to interview Johnny Baker. Johnny is a member of the Church Mission Society and is leading a lot of the youth work and the youth ministry in the Mission Society for the Church of England. Need to say a little bit about the Church Mission Society. It's been around for several hundred years and was founded by the Clapham sect. And those of you who are familiar with the recent movie of Wilberforce and his movement to abolish slavery in the United Kingdom will know about the Clapham sect through that set of relationships. But from that point in time, the Church Mission Society has been sending missionaries overseas and into the UK for these past 200 years. Their focus, of course, has been upon the nature of the gospel in a cross-cultural world. And that has enabled them in this postmodern, post-colonial, and really post-Christian context to focus again on what it means to bear Christian witness in a multicultural context. Johnny, working with the Church Mission Society and a lot of youth, is therefore looking at this question from the perspective of emergent and new forms of church within the Mission Society. The Church Mission Society is also a part of the Church of England, and the Church of England itself is undergoing some very wonderful times of renewal and experimentation. We met with, and in several weeks you will see the video that we did with Bishop Graham Cray. Graham is the Bishop of Mainston, and he was appointed by the Archbishop of Canterbury to this position. And he is the one who edited the recent book Mission-Shaped Church, which has become a huge seller in the UK and even here in North America, which is looking at the shape of existing parishes in the UK and how they need to be reimagined in terms of missional life and the shifting context in which people live. Out of that work, and in cooperation with the Archbishop of Canterbury, has come a whole movement called Fresh Expressions. Fresh Expressions is seeking to invite and to innovate all kinds of what we would call mission-shaped life or missional experiments in ordinary everyday churches all across England. It's a cooperative work of the Church of England and the Methodists. And again, in the next several weeks, we will be making available on the Alalon site a series of videos that capture some of the incredible and exciting ways in which God is moving in a church with a very long history in fresh and exciting ways amongst ordinary people. We were able to meet with Graham at Lambeth House, which is the residence of the Archbishop of Canterbury. We were there at the invitation of Graham and at the invitation of Dr. Martin Robinson, who is the Director of Training and Mission. And again, in several weeks, we will be sharing with you an interview we did with Martin, who is developing a very creative, lay-led, lay-based, locally-based training program in missional leadership all across the UK. This is an initiative which Alalon is partnering with, and we're looking at ways of initiating a similar form of lay-based training here in North America. So we trust that you enjoy this interview. Johnny has some very significant insights into the nature of mission and missional life in the UK.
I'm part of Community Grace, and that came out in the UK, that came out of alternative worship movement or scene, which really was, I mean, the language wasn't about missional church then, it was much more trying to relate worship to club culture, so
right.
It was a cultural question that people were asking, but worship was the starting point. But Grace was one of the things that started out of that. And
whereabouts was that?
That's in London.
In London.
I'm still part of that community, But 2 years ago we had a community weekend and we were talking about the values of the community, and we came up with quite a long list, and then we condensed them down into three, which became four, and we called them our ethos. And it was round about that time that you posted that stuff about how ethos rather than practices was a much better way to go to avoid the kind of trap of legalism. Whatever. So we just had a weekend. Last weekend, funnily enough, we were reflecting on the ethos, and I think when we came up with it, we had no idea how it would become a kind of measure or touchstone or undercurrent, or I don't know what you call it. But it shaped us a lot, and one of our ethos words has been the word engage, which is when we came up with it. I mean, we're very good at engaging with culture, but engage was also a missional kind of word.
Right.
So what would it mean for us to engage? And I think when we came up with the word, if we were honest about it, that part of it was as much aspirational as it was present.
It's what you wanted to become.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But we wanted it in the ethos, because if it wasn't there, we probably were in trouble. But that has kind of, you know, been a challenge and pushed us in that kind of direction a lot more, so we've restructured and whatever. But I that little blog post, or...
I remember writing that.
Yeah.
Well,
it's been a gift.
Well, it was a gift to me too, as I sat with Roy and just had those conversations. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we wouldn't say we were a monastic community in any way, but
right.
It's interesting how that sort of language and ethos has been very, very... I think 2 years on, we might be ready to talk a bit more about if there's any shared spiritual rhythm communally or whatever, which... I mean, we have a pattern of services and follow the church.
Yeah.
Year, and people meet in groups and those kind of things. But if there's anything more than that, we might have a conversation about that, I think. Whether anything will land, I don't know.
Hmm.
But yeah, so that's been good. So that's
that. I appreciate that.
That was good. It's fun. I mean, it's a funny world, isn't it? Blogs, little posts. Sometimes I write a great, what I think is a great post. Nobody comments on it. Nobody links to it. Nobody notices it.
Yeah.
You write something that you just write before breakfast, and people like it. I don't know. It's weird.
Tell me a little bit. I want to get to your blog. You are a part of the Church Mission Society,
yeah,
which is a part of the Church of England.
Yes, it is one of the Anglican mission agencies. Mm-hmm. There are two main ones, USPG, which, yeah, and CMS. And historically, Evangelical Church is linked with CMS for an overseas mission, and Evangelical Church is linked with CMS. That was the kind of... And Africa was carved up. Some countries were USPG, some were CMS.
I see. That was a long time ago?
Yeah, I mean, CMS has been around over 200 years. I mean, it was founded by Wilberforce
and the
Clapham sect. So the same guys that were campaigning about slavery and whatever else, they did a whole load of things like abolishing bear baiting and setting up CMS. I mean, they're an amazing bunch of...
And why did they set up CMS?
I think there was... quite a big discussion around then about going overseas to do mission and whether you could do it if you weren't ordained. There was a whole, you know, it was a much bigger deal, and I think CMS was kind of a subversive way of getting people to go overseas and women involved in ministry somehow.
So it was people being very creative back then.
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah. Although they couldn't get anyone to go.
Oh.
When they started, so they sent a load of Germans for the first 20 years.
Is that right?
From Bavaria. So yeah, CMS is... History is basically typical Western mission thing, sending missionaries to Africa and Asia would be the heartlands. And, you know, sharing the gospel and Western culture in equal measure.
Mm-hmm. He said with a bit of cynicism.
Well, I don't know, I haven't travelled to Africa, but I went to India 2 years ago, and, the churches, I could have been at St. Paul's Cathedral.
Is that right?
Robed up, reading in English... I mean, English is aspirational in the culture, which is also problematic, you know, in terms of getting on in jobs and various things. English is kind of, it sort of plays out weirdly in the culture, I think. But, you know, obviously the gospel taking root in lots of places has been fantastic, but it's that mixed history you get everywhere.
Always. So how did you get hooked up with CMS?
Well, my background's in youth ministry, so I worked for many years with Youth for Christ here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Youth for Christ is a slightly different animal to the US. It's a bit less conservative. I mean, not necessarily theologically, but it's quite an edgy organisation. And I was kind of perceived to be part of their left field, I think. So we did stuff like toured the labyrinth and various things like that that wouldn't be their usual kind of evangelistic approach. But I worked with them for several years doing stuff with young people. And in terms of mission stuff, I was quite influenced by Pete Ward.
Yes.
Some of his writing on youth ministry, that he wrote a book, this is years ago, called Youth Culture and the Gospel, and that was very much talking about cross-cultural mission as a framework for thinking about how we do ministry with young people. And that kind of change, that gave me a language, I think, that I was looking for. So I then started reading missions books.
Cross-cultural language.
Yeah, and, you know, people like Leslie Newbegin and mission stories like Christianity Rediscovered and
Vincent Donovan's work, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that was probably the single book that rocked my world.
It's a powerful book.
Direction. Yeah, it's a great story, yeah. So, yeah, background in youth ministry, but then the connection with alternative worship and Greenbelt Festival over here was very much kind of asking that question about, I mean, wouldn't use the term postmodern then, but postmodern culture, or, you know, just raising questions about church culture and how it seems so wedded to particular cultural forms. So there was a lot of creativity in the UK, particularly it started in worship, but exploring different things there. And that just seemed to join up with the missions thinking as well, you know, same kind of stuff. And then, CMS rang me up and asked me to go and talk to them about working for them.
What were they looking for?
Well, what interested me about it was that they were looking for change. They were asking questions about what did it mean to be a mission agency in a post-colonial world. And they'd set up a team on the edge of the organisation rather than the centre, called the Impact Team. And that included kind of short-term overseas stuff, youth stuff, and the beginnings of them looking at emerging church or mission in the emerging culture here. So it was that combination really that interested me, because I was getting more into more, still doing youth stuff. I mean, I still do stuff with teach youth ministry and so on, but you know, I was very much asking questions about church and culture and the emerging church conversation that was beginning over here. So I could just tick so many of the boxes of what they were looking for. And I was very interested in changing organisations, which or how they change, I think. So I ended up joining CMS, and it, also I thought these were the guys that ought to know about cross-cultural mission. You know, I felt like I'd been fishing a bit in that, so it would be great to go and learn some more about that stuff. And that's been good. I mean, it's an institution that's been around over 200 years,
yes.
So it's not without its struggle to change, but there's some pretty radical changes going on at the moment.
Well, talking about institutions that have been around for 200 years, I mean, CMS is part of an institution that's been around for 800 years, longer than that, the Church of England.
Mm.
So, I mean, it sounds like, and I'm thinking as a North American now, so, but it sounds like you've got some very old institutions in terms of history, which are cultivating some very creative things.
The Anglican Church in the UK is, well, I don't know if it's unique, but it has a very different feel at the moment to some other countries in the world, and that'd be true of my visits to both Canada and the US.
Talk a little bit about that.
Well, I think particularly in relation to mission and the emerging culture and so on, this is obviously going to be simplistic, but I'll dive in and you can give a spin on it as well, maybe. But one of the things I think I felt when I visited the Anglican Church in North America and places, that it has a different feel to it, and it got me thinking about what was good about the Anglican Church here. And I think two strands that have shaped the Anglican Church in the last 30 years or so here, more, 40, would be charismatic renewal. So, I mean, we were talking about John Wimber earlier, but, you know, the influence on people like David Watson and the early days of charismatic renewal, which were uniquely kind of polite English within a sort of liturgical framework. Mm-hmm. You know, you'd sort of, the spirit might break out for 5 minutes and then we'd have the creed or something. Mm-hmm. You know, it was quite fun. But the influence of people like David Watson, and then the renewal that came in worship through a number of different streams, actually. Vineyard would have been one, but, you know, a whole bunch of other ones. And in recent years, things like Teze and Iona and Northumbria, they've been renewing streams from different places. But that charismatic renewal has kind of given the Church of England and the UK and wider, I think, a softness to the spirit. Not everywhere, but it's permeated through. I mean, around that time, quite a lot of independent churches were set up, house church movements that became denominations. It's interesting because in the last 5 years, quite a few of them have imploded over crises in leadership.
The house churches?
Yeah, quite a few of the structures, you know, they've had difficulties like Ichthys and Pioneer and those sorts of things. I mean, and Revelation Church. I mean, they're all still going on in their own way, but they've had real problems, and a lot of people suddenly felt, actually, maybe being connected to the Anglican thing isn't such a bad deal after all. You know, because everybody feels like leaving whatever they're in at some time. Mm-hmm. I think that's the nature of church, isn't it?
It seems often, it would be interesting, your comment that a lot of these movements are created by creative individuals, but they don't seem to manage to be able to move past or hand on the leadership past those founding individuals.
Yeah, that's been totally the issue in the UK. That'd be my outside observation on some of those movements. Whereas, love it or hate it, bishops and all the rest of it, at least there's a kind of system of governance in place that is going to pass on. And then I'd say the second big influence in the Anglican Church in the UK is youth ministry. There's been quite an investment over the years in youth ministry, and I think Pete Ward, who I was mentioning before, was very influential in that. He was appointed as the Archbishop's advisor on youth ministry. He always used to appoint someone for a year or two, and various youth ministry training things were set up. But over here, youth ministry has been the back door for renewing the church for years. You could do stuff in youth ministry, and then 10, 15 years later, that will be the culture of the main church. I mean, that's why I've enjoyed hanging out in youth ministry, because it's quite a subversive activity in the long run, I think. And in fact, a lot of the emerging church stuff is youth ministers that have grown up over here, who've kind of, you know, done mission amongst young people outside the church, had their frustrations, and now are thinking they've got to address the church question or address that with adults. So I think those two things had a big influence on the Anglican Church here, coupled with a number of people that stuck it out in the Anglican Church through difficult times. I mean, I was mentioning Bob and Mary Hopkins earlier. They'd be a great example of people that have stayed with the Anglican Church, this is a term of Bob's, been loyal radicals. I mean, they wouldn't necessarily use it about themselves, but I mean, I was doing a thing in Princeton talking about the emerging church stuff, and their question was, you know, how do mainline denominations change? I mean, it's small question, but I'd been asked to talk about the Anglican Church here and mission-shaped church and what had happened. But I rang Bob Hopkins up about it and said, look, you do this stuff a lot more than me. What are your top three tips? One of his was that one of the key factors was if they could hold on to some loyal radicals. So they're always characters, I mean, I don't know what you'd call them, prophetic or people that see things differently, that are uncomfortable, whether for organisations or churches or whatever, but I think somehow the Anglican Church here managed to, well, both those people managed to hang in there and the Anglican Church managed to let them hang in there. So what's happened now is that we're in a space where quite a lot of those people actually have quite a bit of influence, and there's a lot of good people, a lot of good bishops, a lot of permission for mission. So the report, I'm sure you're familiar with, Mission Shaped Church, was published several years ago, and that's been a real permission-giving document. I mean, it's partly fueled by crisis, because the church as it has been is unsustainable economically and in terms of personnel, particularly rural areas, you've got a priest having to look after 8 churches, you know, how do you do that? So the whole thing's in meltdown in some places. So there's nothing like pressure to fuel creativity, you That's think. Right. But it is a, broadly speaking, there is a permission given culture, and very different to 10 years ago. You know, I've heard bishops talk about themselves as permission givers. So the advice is to come, I mean, this is the advice I give bishops and so on when I talk to them, is almost to say, well, what you need to do is keep the relationship and bless everything in sight. You know, and it, because people want to stay related and connected and just see how it works out. So I felt like when I visited the US, the Episcopal Church there, or in Canada in places, that it just feels a bit drier and tougher. You know, it hasn't got the softness or.
And that softness is, as you would describe it, this openness to what the Spirit's up to that really came in through these gentle charismatics like David Watson. And
I think so, yeah. I mean, there's obviously renewal come from other directions.
Sure.
I mean, the Anglican Church has got a number of
the whole youth side is another.
Yeah, and then the Anglo-Catholic side has its own renewing streams and so on. So it's kind of come from a number of places. And, I mean, by saying that, I don't want to be misheard or misread to say that I think the Episcopal Church is hard in the US, but it just has a different tone, a different feel to it.
Sure.
I mean, I actually feel quite hopeful about some of the things going on in the US in the mainline denominations at the moment. I think there are more and more people asking questions about changing culture and mission and so on.
What interests me, and I'd be fascinated with your comments, today when we were at Lambeth, Graham Cray was describing some of the developments of Fresh Expressions.
Yeah.
And was talking about why the language Fresh Expressions was chosen. He said, for example, mission language is too technical, people aren't there. Emergent language tends to have kind of ideology attached to it. Fresh Expressions is language already within Anglican Church, and so it gathers. And what struck me was that here are you, Johnny Baker, who in many ways represents what you would call an emergent youth culture side of things, and you have Graham Cray, who is a bishop in the church, saying a lot of the same things together. And I find that quite different from what I experience in North America, where too often I hear emergent language being used over against what we would call institutional churches or organized churches, and the need to push away from that and say we've got to start new. I hear you describing yourself within an emergent culture, but really sharing inside the Anglican Church this common space. That's quite a different experience. Do you want to comment on that, Annie?
Yeah, I mean, there are people over here who are doing stuff that's post-denominational or outside of a denominational context, and there'd be plenty of people who'd be in denominational context where it's driving them nuts and they can't get permission to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not all good in the denominational setup here. And I think you could find plenty of people that would perhaps have that tone over and against the institutions of the church. And I mean, I tend to try to be as big-hearted as far as possible and think that renewal flows in both directions.
Mm-hmm.
You often get people that kind of sail out on the edge, sometimes they leave or whatever and do a new thing, and that grows a life of its own. And then you have the loyal radicals on the inside. If you get new stuff growing in both directions and then they move towards each other, I think that can often be good if the relationship with the people that left isn't too damaged, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
And that, one of the things there is about maturity of leaders, I think, which perhaps that's some of what you're getting at. But, I mean, one of the differences here between the emerging church and emergent in the US is exactly what you're saying, how it's located in relation to the mainline denominations. And that's all about context. You know, we have to try and work out how to follow Christ in our context, and you guys have to do that over there. But yeah, I mean, I don't know how to. I don't want to get into a fight about it, really.
No, I'm not inviting a fight. Just your reflections on this capacity for these quite different streams to walk together.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a danger, and perhaps I could say this, there's a danger and an opportunity in the US. This is my view from the outside. I know the emergent guys well, whose language has been over and against, as you've said, because they've come from a different kind of place, much more independent churches, perhaps in their background. In terms of Christian identity, you know, your identity when you're independent is built over and against what is perceived to be liberal or whatever else. And perhaps when you change the theology and whatever else, that shaped you maybe in more ways than you realise. But whilst that's kind of grown up, and that's where the Young Leaders Network and whatever else had its roots, I think everyone's kind of shifting a bit in their thinking and sort of. So the challenge is, well, it seems to me, whether those guys and girls can lose that over and against. But the opportunity, I think, is that surprisingly, you know, there are Lutherans, Episcopalians, Presbyterians, very interested in missional stuff, kind of meeting for coffees and talking, and some of them, you know, come over here and travel, and they connect with the Anglican thing because it's a mainline denomination. They can see that might afford them a language that they can relate to better than some of the emergent writing that feels more over and against it. I think one of the postmodern things, language makes the world, and I think people feel that. They need a language that resonates in their culture. So I think there is a big opportunity there, but it's kind of, it feels to me, being set up in a way that needs to melt down a bit if the opportunities to kind of be built on. You know, I don't know how to put it as positively as I can. You know, I mean, I think I'd want to focus on the opportunity that's there. I mean, my sense from Brian McLaren is that he very much wants to build bridges and relationships and so on, and a lot of the other guys are following suit. So the Emergent Manifesto has a lot of stuff about other voices, and you know, I think they're trying quite hard to seize that opportunity. But at the same time, you've got people in denominations who are frustrated because they still feel that the language isn't where they're at. So it's whether these guys can have the maturity to build a future together, or maybe it's futures together.
In the conservative side of the church, that's certainly what's going on.
And then, you know, other things in the US, you'd know better than me, but there's all the new monasticism stuff. You know, there's a whole number of strands, and it's a question of how they join up. But the people that connect best with us over here, I think, are those that are more in denominational settings, just because they see some resources that fuel what they're doing. So people like Karen Ward build great friendships over here. I mean, bizarrely, quite a few Episcopalians on the West Coast come over here. You know, we've been over there, done worship there, and I think, I mean, I've done quite a bit of stuff in the US with, like, the United Church, that I think quite a few people wouldn't bother going and being with. But they're asking the same kind of questions, you know, because they don't like their stance on sexuality or whatever. You think that there's nothing going on there, but actually these guys are trying to work out how to do mission and be missional in the context that they're in. So my take on all that is to be as big-hearted as possible, and if people want to, if they're asking a question about how do we join in with what God is doing, then that seems to be a great question.
It's a great question.
Why not go and talk to them about
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely,
I think we had an email exchange about this, so I can't remember, but, you know, God's always surprised me. You know, wherever we think we got the thing sussed or whatever, God's always out of that box doing something new in surprising places. And I think we don't have to, but it helps if we'll have the humility to trust that God can rework in the places we've written off.
So what are some of the things that are surprising you?
Well, one of the surprising things, just this week, we're running a stand at a Mind Body Spirit Festival in London, which is sort of, I guess it's like a New Age fair. It's been going about 30 years, but it's one of the big festivals in the UK. But in terms of mission, that raises all sorts of kind of questions and challenges in terms of what's God doing, what's going on with people. Opposite us, we've got a lovely woman who runs a stand called Everyday Angels.
This is at the event.
Yeah.
Everyday Angels.
She paints pictures of angels. Her mission is to get an angel into every house in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
She thinks angels are messengers of blessing. And a lot of the messages that she has with her pictures of angels, they sound like they're kingdom stuff, forgiveness, light, healing, whatever else. So, you're in conversation with someone like that and trying to connect that with your tradition and scriptures and whatever else. And it's, I think that's a surprising environment. This is only the second year we've done it. We're pretty new, and we've called our stand Dekomai, which sounds like a mind-body-spirit word.
Dekomai.
Yeah, it's a Greek word. Uh-huh. It means the welcoming place, so it's kind of what we wanted to offer. So we offer free prayer, foot massage, prayer for healing, and pray for lots of people. And I mean, last year and this year, the word gets out that the energy is strong in our booth, so people come to us because
they want the energy.
The vibes are good.
Yeah. Hey,
so that's good. God is with us.
Great context.
Yeah, but in terms of surprises, I think when I went in there, I didn't expect. I mean, you just kind of go in thinking you know stuff, do you know what I mean? But it's much more grey, some of these other things, than you think. What is God doing in this woman's life? As a teenager or whatever, you'd have protested outside these things or prayed against them or whatever. But, there's a hunger and a thirst for the spirit. And, a lot of the stuff is just health and massage and those kind of things. I mean, there's definitely a kind of occult light side of the festival as well, but I think that's been a surprising place, to connect with people. And I was saying to someone this morning when we were setting up that people are much more open to prayer there than they are at church. If you ask someone ask someone at church you want prayer at the end of it, they'll go, oh no, I'm fine. Here they'll be like, can I have some healing, can I have some prayer? They want to be prayed for. It's very interesting. So that's one place.
That's a great surprise.
Yeah. And that's been good for us. This is part of the engage thing for us in terms of grace, is to say, well, how do we take some of... Because I think one of the things in the UK alternative worship's been great at is exploring contemplative spirituality and ways that connects culturally, some of the symbolism. But we've done a lot of that in church spaces for ourselves, and that's been good. But part of the challenge is how can we take some of this stuff and do it in spaces that aren't church.
And so that it's interesting that the engage is not a law or a rule or a program, but it is an ethos.
It's an ethos.
And so
absolutely, yeah.
When that ethos gets inside you and you look across the street, you go, let's go join and engage.
Yeah.
And when you do that, God surprises you.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's
neat. That's the idea. And I think that's shaping, in terms of grace, the Mind, Body, Spirit stand isn't just grace. There's a few people from CMS and Moot and other groups in London. There's a whole bunch of people involved. But I think people are finding that's challenging them individually in terms of how they might use their time. So rather than thinking, right, I'll go to a church group this and whatever it's like, well, let's have one planning group meeting a month, get the stuff out of the way, and then the other time let's think, what can we join in the community to be part of and build relationships and connect with people and so on. And then it's communally asking, I don't know, where we've done installations in the church, we're kind of saying, well, how can we do this, the same kind of thing, but let's do it in an art space? Or, you know, yeah. I mean, a basic question.
But it's interesting, and you know, you may say to me, I don't know, but here's another reflection. Wherever we've gone in the UK and sat with and listened to the stories of varieties of churches, whether it's the inner city,
yeah,
or in a rural place, the same thing keeps emerging, which is, this is about, they use like, it's about kingdom work.
Yeah.
And what they mean is, we're here for the people in this community.
Yeah.
And you just keep getting struck by something has taken hold amongst churches, maybe it's not all of them, in which it says what we're about as a church, whether it's Grace or the Moot or these little churches out in villages, it's how do we connect with people?
Yeah.
But they're not connecting with people in order to, in the old-fashioned sense, evangelize them, get them in.
Yeah.
Here's an observation I would make. Across all, whether it's the missional conversation in North America or the emergent conversation in America or the church planting conversation in North America, take your label and listen long enough, and most of it is a conversation about the church.
Yeah.
And so it's an internal conversation. Why the church isn't working, how to make the church better, how to plant more churches, blah, blah, blah. There's a different conversation going on over here. And your language is engagement. It's pitching the tent beside the other. How did that come about? Or am I being unfair?
No, I mean, I think that's a very hopeful, it's a very hopeful thing you've said. I hope that's true. I mean, I think it is amazing how mission or missions or missional has become part of the conversation in the UK and grown steadily in a lot of places. So it's kind of like it's a big shift gone on, I think. But I think it's a number of influences. I don't know what the tipping point is in it, but it's people that have written, published, talked, preached. I mean, you know, there are people like Graham Cray, as you say, who are bishops doing stuff, and then there's the whole blogging world conversation. Greenbelt's been a very important space.
These festivals
here.
That are so big, yeah, here in the United Kingdom.
And there's quite a lot of, I suppose, networking that goes on. I mean, I think the internet does help these kind of things a lot, because mm-hmm. there's just that viral way that ideas get out there and spread and so on. But I mean, I think broadly I agree with you over here. I mean, whether that is or isn't the same in the US, I don't know. I mean, one of my reflections on the US, I mean, we get quite a few people passing through London who I regularly meet people for coffee who just want to touch base or whatever. And I met a group of pastors, I think they're United Brethren or something, from Pennsylvania. And the last question they asked, we had about an hour together, one of the guys said, well, you know, what's your observation on the American church?
Hmm.
You know, it was like, well, is there something you kind of observe? And the thing that I shared with him, and maybe it connects with what you're saying, is that the church here is kind of not big enough to sustain a powerful subculture in the same way that it is in the US. So, I mean, it depends where you are in the US.
Sure.
But in a lot of places, you can, you know, virtually have Christian hairdo, Christian schooling, Christian... Do you know what I mean? You can live in that bubble quite...
Cradle to grave.
Yeah, quite easily. Mm-hmm. Whereas here, there isn't the economic infrastructure in churches to sustain. I mean, there are a few Christian record labels, a Christian radio station. You know, if you're desperate to, you can. But I think it's much harder to sustain that. So, and I think that's actually been a gift here in terms of the connection with community, that it's harder to be that dualistic in the UK. But there is, I mean, as you say, there has been a sort of groundswell rising of kingdom stuff wanting to connect with communities, and that is very hopeful.
Yeah, it's very hopeful. I have been really delighted because I'm not hearing we're going to connect with our neighbors because that's a strategy.
Too. Yeah.
I'm not hearing that language. I'm hearing that's what it means to be God's people in this community.
Yeah.
And I'm hearing things like, it doesn't matter whether people come to our church. It's that they discover this kingdom life.
Very
hopeful.
But I think what you're... I mean, it's interesting, because what you're describing, the difference between... is almost between strategy and ethos.
That's right, yes.
That's a very good way to put it. It doesn't sound that different, but having been through what we've been through in Grace, thinking about ethos, I mean, you mentioned neighbours.
Mm-hmm.
We've intentionally invited our neighbours round on both sides of our house in the last few months. I mean, we're not great extroverts, my wife and I, but, you know, it's been great building relationships with them. But it's not a strategy, but we've been almost compelled to or want to do it because we have this ethos of engage that's shaping our life. And I think it sounds like a small difference, but strategy and ethos,
massive.
I think, yeah, they're big. It's a good...
Yeah.
I'll use that.
Well, no, you... thank you for it, because I think you've really put your finger on... There is an ethos.
Yeah.
And it comes naturally, at least in the conversations we've been having, and with quite a few people, so this is not based upon, you know, one or two little things here. Talk a little bit the blogging world. You do a lot of blogging.
I suppose you do.
That's how I connected with you.
Yeah. Well, I blog because Andrew Jones made me.
Ah, and why did Andrew make you?
I don't know.
A great ethos statement.
I'm sure he's done the same to many people. No, he was staying at my house one. This is years ago. It was quite early in the. Certainly in terms of the emerging stuff, blogging world. Andrew showed me a blog and said I should start one, so I did. And I've not stopped.
So you say the internet's a big deal in a lot of what's going on.
Well, I think it is. I mean, publishing's always been a big deal, I think. You know, whether in print or radio or... It's sharing information. And I'm a fan of publishing, but I think part of the internet thing is the democratization of that and the ability to self-publish. I like a lot, and the connectivity with it. I mean, actually, I think the values of the web, you know, participation, self-publishing, connectivity, when it works well, an economy of gift, those kind of things, they actually sit well with some of the values of the emerging culture and the emerging church. So I think they kind of go well together. I mean, I don't want to overstate the blog thing, but it doesn't cease to surprise me who kind of pops up and reads your blog, and you meet people all around the world and they're reading your stuff. And again, it's surprising who, because it's accessible and available to people. So I've kind of enjoyed the blog world. It's fun, but...
So what kind of conversations are you discovering?
I mean, one of the fun ones I've enjoyed in the last year... I mean, I've connected with lots of people in the emerging church conversation. That kind of goes without saying, maybe. But a fun one I had in the last year was that a very influential book in terms of my own thinking about creativity was this book called A Whack on the Side of the Head.
A Whack on the Side of the Head.
Which is back in the 70s, I think, by a guy called Roger Van Eyck.
Mm-hmm.
And it's...
Somebody else has told me about
it. It's a bit like, you know, Edward de Bono's stuff.
Yes.
Teach your child how to think or whatever. It's kind of looking at creativity and saying it's not... There are things you can do to help develop your creativity. And it's a fun book. Anyway, I read this book, and the team that I was in then working with Youth for Christ, it became a kind of saying when we were planning stuff, you know, we need a whack on the side of the head, we've got to get the creative juices flowing. So we'd try some strategies to come up with ideas. So it was a very creative environment, and I've recognised since then that I've, you know, part of the ethos in our family has always been creativity, and it is in Grace and so on. But I can't quite remember how I mentioned this book or whatever, and Roger, it turns out, runs a blog and put a comment on my my blog saying, hi, I've started blogging over here, whatever, and so I connected up with him, and we've to and fro'd on that, and then he did an interview with me about what I did, because he was interested in terms of creativity, so he connects with a whole different bunch of people that love ideas and that sort of management kind of world and so on. So that was a really good connection.
Fascinating,
because it was like, you know, it's this thing of language, because we've got so much jargon in missions and emerging church and whatever else. So he was asking what I did. So one of the lines I came up with that I thought was quite good in terms of my job, because that's always a difficult one. What do you do?
What do you do?
I give a different answer to every person. I keep trying things out, but the answer I gave in that interview was, my job is to give the church a whack on the side of the head. That's all. That was pretty cool.
That is gorgeous. Yeah. That's
so that was a fun. That was a fun blog connection. That was a real surprise. And perhaps another one I've enjoyed a lot. I mean, the ones I'm thinking of are shaped by the Engage thing, I suppose, because that's where I'm at personally at the moment, is looking to making connections in a different world. I love photography, so a year or so back, my wife gave me a digital SLR camera, which just made all the difference in terms of taking photos. So I post photos on Flickr, which is a photo sharing website, and it's a social networking thing as well, you know, comment on other people's photos and join groups, etc. I mean, you can live in that world, but I found a lot of connectivity through taking photos. A lot of people comment about my photos, and I've now joined a photography group in Ealing where I live, which has been good fun, and also there's a Flickr group in London and Ealing, so I've made kind of connections with those people. So again, that blogging world and the world of the internet and social networking, I found some fun connections in terms of a shared interest in photography.
Wow. So what's giving you energy these days?
Oh dear. I don't know. I felt tired
it's
recently.
Late at night.
I'm looking forward to the end of this Mind Body Spirit Festival. I've got a few days off. I mean, the kinds of things that energise me, I love art stuff, creative stuff. So one of the things I really enjoyed in the last few days is there's an artist called Anthony Gormley who's you should check this out tomorrow if you're still here. If you go down to Waterloo Bridge and walk across to the Hayward Gallery, there's an exhibition by Anthony Gormley, but he's done these life-size sculpture figures, and they're on about 30 buildings that you can see from there. So you look round, and they're really high up, some of them. A couple of them are on the bridge. So you just see these figures. They're kind of making visible what's invisible. Or, I mean, the exhibition is called Blind Light, but I mean, for me, it spoke of sort of angelic kind of presences, or you know, he's made visible some figures, but what other figures are not normally visible? So I loved that, and I, you know, took my camera down, took some photos or whatever. Those kind of things energise me a lot. I get energised by reading. Enjoy that. I get energised by, I don't know, a day standing on the beach, looking at the sea or something. Those are the kind of things that are energising me at the moment. I mean, in terms of faith, I do like the monastic stuff. I think that I met Ray Simpson, who's the guardian of the community of Hilda and Aidan, last week, and had a chat with him over a beer, and I find that whole thing fascinating. And I think the question, I suppose, that I'm living with at the moment, having discovered how foundational this notion of ethos can be in a community's life, is whether there can be a spiritual rhythm that is uncovered, that can be life-giving in the same way, but that doesn't get into some kind of, that doesn't legalise the joy that the ethos is bringing. I think that's a question.
It's
on
a fine line.
Yeah. So do you know the answer to that one? You've done some exploring.
That's what the abbots were about. The abbots were constantly about, how do you guard the ethos?
Yeah, I love that term.
And in guarding the ethos, shape the people in your community without it becoming a legalism.
Yeah.
And so one of the ways to get at what you're asking is to explore who were these abbots and abbesses, and what were they up to?
Hmm.
And it's a very different kind of, what would we say, leadership role than those that are normally identified today in church communities.
Mm.
But my own sense is that without those sorts of people who are not intrusive people, but they're people who are looked to within a community, and they're people who have time to do this sort of thing. Without that, it's difficult to keep the tension of the ethos and, in some senses, some of the practices.
Yeah.
You need practices, but practices aren't at this church, here's what we do.
Yeah, sure, yeah.
You know, it's something very different.
Yeah.
But it's the abbot or the abbess kind of person who can cultivate that kind of world.
Mm. Yeah. Interesting. And your one of the things that interested me about you, I wanted to ask you about, was I know you've done work with denominations or dioceses or whatever. And I mean, I haven't read your latest book. I just looked up and
you've
written one.
You're forgiven.
I must check that out, because that's obviously got some of you thinking.
I'm making the sign now, so keep going.
Yeah. But I met a guy, John someone, who's in Melbourne Diocese of the Church of Christ.
Yes, John Gilmore.
Yeah. And he was speaking very positively about the work that you've done with them. So, I mean, I was...
I can say now he's a wonderful guy.
Yeah. But I was interested in that, because certainly with CMS, we have quite a lot of openings, favour. I get invited to speak to groups, diocese groups of vicars or whatever. And sometimes when you go there, you feel like, is this... You know, how do you make a real difference to that? When institutional life is so, I don't know, people have a lot of good intention and good heart, but they go back and have got to keep the roof on, or...
Right.
Sometimes when you speak about the missional stuff, you sense there are people there who kind of remember this is what they signed up for.
That's right.
You know what I mean? You can see that, but then they're thinking, oh no, they're also feeling exhausted because they're thinking, how am I going to do this as well?
On top of everything else.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you're naming all the issues.
So I wonder what you were learning, I suppose, in that.
Sure. That's a long conversation, but I can give you some brief pieces to it. I think your descriptions of a lot of parishes or congregations or denominational systems is absolutely accurate. You have leaders, ministers, pastors who are where you're describing. They're worn out. They feel like they're taking care of everything, and there's little time left in the day. And they also, as genuinely good people, don't have a clue what to do. In other words, they know how to manage a world, but they know it's a world that doesn't exist anymore. And that creates high anxiety.
Yeah.
And they don't want to be shamed. At the same time, in a lot of these congregations, you do have people who are confused and are struggling to make sense of what's happened and feel like they're living in a world that increasingly doesn't fit their explanations. And so what you have to do is really invite them to discover some things in the midst of that anxiety. I can tell you things that you don't do. You don't try to create big change process. That just messes things up terribly. They already know that things are not working, so they don't need to be told that you're in a terrible place or anything else like that. They need to find hope. And so what I do with others is really invite them into a process, and that requires tools and skills and resources, but it's a process of rediscovering their narratives of hope, which are always there. And they're always there because in any congregation, the Spirit of God is present. And of course, that's why I have a very difficult time with people who want to write off the church, these churches, because it's a deeply theological thing. They're not just writing off churches. They're saying something about the limits of God's capacity. God's Spirit is there. But the way to engage that is to live back into those narratives of hope. The second thing is that these folk hardly ever know how to talk to each other anymore about the things that matter or what they're experiencing. And I don't mean that in kind of a psychological way. So,
do you mean the congregations or the
leaders? Yeah, the congregations and the leaders.
Yeah.
My experience is with pastors and ministers that there are hardly any opportunities for them to voice what's actually going on inside them. And so part of what we do, to coin another phrase, is ask how do we work and walk beside people to listen them into free speech? Because inside folk, if the Spirit of God is there, are words and imaginations and dreams. But most of these people don't believe they can dream anymore. And so we introduce some ways in which they can listen to stories of hope and they can begin to articulate their own senses of dream and hope. And then we invite them to discover how to create some experiments. How do you create an environment for ministers and the church people where you say, it's okay to experiment? And again, for a lot of these people, it isn't. I don't know over here, but my experience in North America is we create churches where experimenting is the last thing people want to do because failure is not welcomed.
Yeah.
So it's how do you invite them to discover this in some very simple ways? So what I do is work with a cluster, a group of congregations, not just one, and with those who have oversight of them, basically teaching them how to do some of these things that I've just described. And it takes time.
Yeah.
So the other part of it is that if you're serious about engaging these kinds of churches, you got to love them and you got to be committed to them not as a project, but I'm going to engage with them, to use your ethos conversation. And it's amazing what happens when that takes place. Now, I don't want to pretend that it's just kind of easy wave the wand. It requires real skill, and you need tools and resources to do it. But so that's what happens. That's what I do.
Mm.
Now that's not filling in all the spaces.
No, I mean that might be for a.
That's probably another conversation. I'd be happy to have
a conversation, and it might be for a conversation with CMS as well, because I think. I'm sure we'd have lots to learn.
Yeah, well, I don't know. But I'll be back here in August, and I'd be happy to have that conversation. I've both done that in Australia and in North America, and with a colleague finished a research project in which that was exactly the question we were asking. How do you engage existing churches and their systems and invite them in a fresh expressions or missional imagination, whatever language you want to use. So we learn a lot, and I think have a very practical sense of how you go about it. So I'd be happy to talk to you about it.
Yeah, and your last book covers some of that stuff, doesn't it?
The last book looks at the question of leadership rather than the congregations. I have kind of down the line another book on congregations, but this last book is about how do you form missional leaders? Now, it has inside of it some of the basic sort of frameworks.
Yeah.
So if you look at that book, you'll start to get some of the frameworks that we've learned and discovered. What the book doesn't do, and this is about publishers and what publishers will allow in terms of what they think people can read, is it doesn't go into what I would call the theological imagination.
Yeah.
Some of it's there. And I would say more than anything else, the most important thing to do is work on what's the theological imagination underlying this. Because Because at the end of the day, it's not about techniques or tools. It's about how do you listen and discern what God is up to amongst the people. And just as we ask that question, what's God up to in the neighborhood? When you go into these kinds of churches with their leaders, it's still legitimate to ask, what's God up to? And how do you invite these people back into a process of spiritual discernment?
The Roxburgh Journal is an Alelo Netcast. Executive producer, Mark Priddy. Written and produced by Alan Roxburgh. Line producer, Sarah Jane Walker. Edited and mixed by Bill Kinnon. Original music, Substance Over Style. Webmaster, Brian Martini. Thanks for listening.